I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The Independent Commission looking into the terrorist attacks of September 11th says it found no credible evidence of a link between Iraq and al-Qaeda in the planning or funding of the attacks. The commission's conclusion comes a day after President Bush supported Dick Cheney's claim that Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein had longstanding ties with al-Qaeda. The 9/11 Commission is wrapping up its work in two final days of hearings. It's planning to release its final report next month. Today, the commission is examining the vast al-Qaeda network, reporting, among other things, that Osama bin Laden made overtures to Saddam Hussein in 1994, but was rebuffed by the Iraqi leader. There were plenty of other countries that rolled out the welcome mat, including Sudan and Afghanistan. Here's a staff person of the commission reading from the findings.
Many of the operatives in the African embassy and coal attacks attended training camps in Afghanistan, as did all 19 of the 9/11 hijackers. There was a mutually reinforcing relationship between the camps and terrorist operations. The camps provided the operatives for the terrorist attacks. Successful attacks boosted camp recruitment and attendance. The quality of training provided at al-Qaeda and other jihadist camps was apparently quite good. There was coordination with regard to curriculum, emphasis on ideological and religious indoctrination, and instruction that underscored that the United States and Israel were evil and that the rulers of Arab countries were illegitimate. The camps created a climate in which trainees and other personnel were free to think creatively about ways to commit mass murder. According to a senior al-Qaeda associate, various ideas were floated by Mujahideen in Afghanistan, such as taking over a launcher and forcing Russian scientists to fire a nuclear missile at the United States, mounting mustard gas or cyanide attacks against Jewish areas in Iran, dispensing poison gas into the air conditioning system of a targeted building, and last but not least, hijacking an aircraft and crashing it into an airport terminal or nearby city.
Also today, Commissioner Jamie Gorelick questioned FBI agent John Pistol about the current status of al-Qaeda.
Our staff statement concludes about al-Qaeda now that it's a loose confederation of regional networks with greatly weakened central organization. And so my question for the panel is this. Does that mean that it is less capable of harming us, or is it more a multi-headed snake that is, in fact, more potent?
The one thing that I would have added to the staff statement, because it is true, al-Qaeda is a much more decentralized organization today. But bin Laden, Zawahiri, and the al-Qaeda leadership that remains is in South Asia. It is actively pooling whatever resources it has left at its disposal. And in a very centralized and methodical way, we believe that it is plotting an attack and moving an attack forward, using what capabilities it has left to attack the homeland in the next few months.
Hearings continue throughout today and tomorrow, when the 9/11 Commission is expected to look into the Pentagon's response to the attacks. Meanwhile, the 9/11 Commission has also found new evidence that the hijackers were originally looking at an earlier date to launch the attack, possibly in May or June of 2001. Washington Post reporter Dan Egan is covering that part of the story. He was the first to report that the hijackers needed more time. We spoke earlier, and I asked him about his findings.
The conventional wisdom and the evidence in the past has pointed to two theories. One was that they were always looking at a window of time around 9/11, or in that time frame, September of 2001 or so. And the other was that they were, in fact, looking later in the year, but moved it up because Zacharias Moussaoui, who has been charged by the government as a conspirator in the plot, was arrested in August in Minnesota. This new information suggests that, in fact, there was an original earlier time frame of May or June of 2001, but that the Mohammed Atta, the leading hijacker, and the others weren't ready.
Why weren't they ready?
We do know that the hijackers did not even start taking practice flights until May of 2001. They may well have just been running behind.
There's also evidence that the hijackers were considering other airports. What else does this tell us about their plans?
There is wide agreement that there was no magic about the September 11th date. And you may recall there was a lot of speculation after the attacks, that there was a great meeting in 9/11, 911 being the emergency number for the U.S., you know, that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
The evidence shows that that was not the case. Before they began buying tickets in late August. Several of the hijackers were, they know this through computer records, were emailing and surfing the web looking for ticket prices and looking at various tickets on various kinds of flights, from the all of them from the East Coast, major airports on the East Coast. But they were mostly looking at trying to find the right combination so that they could accommodate 19 men in the right kind of seats on 767 and 757 jetliners.
And those jetliners because?
They had practiced on those. The ones trained as pilots had trained on one or more of those jetliners. And they also concentrated on those when they went on their reconnaissance flights from May to August of 2001, when they just went as passengers in either first class or business class.
Hmm. Well, Dan, you know, some might say the end result is all that really matters. You know, 3,000 people died in three locations. What does this matter, this new information?
In May, and particularly June and July of 2001, in the words of George Tenet, everyone's hair was on fire,
right,
in the intelligence community about the level of intelligence they were getting indicating an imminent attack. What might have been different then? There was a higher state of readiness. It's been fairly well documented that things slackened off some in August. So there's that scenario. There's also, I think, probably the more heartbreaking part of it is the more personal view of many family members who are simply left with the possibility that their loved one might not have been aboard one of the flights. Mm. Their loved one might have not been in the towers, might not have had the job they had that day.
Well, and also it would seem to me that it's a window into the possibility that they may not have gotten it together. You know, that it was hard to get, as you said, 19 seats on separate planes that would coincide. And
that's very true. It shows sort of two sides of the coin. One is that the difficulties they encountered, and it also shows, it seems to indicate the methodical nature of their planning and the extent to which they were, you know, trying to manage this, so to speak. I mean, what they believe the evidence shows is that in terms of the postponement was that Osama bin Laden himself was pushing for a May or June date, and that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed convinced him that Atta was not ready.
Hmm. Dan, thank you.
Thank you.
Dan Egan, reporter for The Washington Post.
We're joined now by James Bamford. He is the author of several books on the U.S. intelligence community, including The Puzzle Palace. His newest work is a preview of what we've been finding out in today's 9/11 hearings. It's called A Pretext for War, 9/11, Iraq, and the Abuse of America's Intelligence Agencies. Jim, welcome.
Oh, thanks very much.
I know you've been watching the hearings as we have, and we've been hearing for hours now about how al-Qaeda was able to move various players into place before 9/11. Any surprises for you here?
There weren't a lot of surprises. One of them was they mentioned that apparently they obtained this from statements from Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, one of the key people who planned this. One of the things he apparently told them was that one of the targets that the plane that crashed, what its goal was to hit the Capitol because they wanted to attack the U.S. Capitol as a result of the way the Capitol, the U.S. Congress votes for pro-Israel support, money, military, and so forth. So there was a lot of speculation before as to whether it was headed for the White House or the Capitol, and that seems to have settle the question.
And the Washington Post, Dan Egan, reminded us a moment ago about how U.S. intelligence agencies essentially had their hair on fire trying to track down a lot of these things during the summer of 2001, which does make you wonder, how could they know so much and still not be able to put it together, or is this just the clarity of 2020 hindsight?
Well, that's true. One of the things that hasn't really come up yet is the fact that the Bin Laden had a press conference, basically, with a reporter from Middle East Television in June of 2001. He didn't say much, but he was there, and his associates basically said that his organization was going to attack the United States in the near future. And he basically nodded his head to all this. He had agreed with the ruler of the Taliban not to talk to the press personally, but he had his associates talk to him. And it was after that that all of a sudden all this chatter, all the excitement took place in the in the Arab world, and it was that was picked up by the United States and indicated that something was going to happen.
Hard to be much more clear than that. In your book, you describe a secret CIA unit called Alex Station, which only had one job starting in 1996, and that was to track down Osama bin Laden. Obviously, wasn't able to do that enough to stop the attacks. Why not?
Well, the problem was that the Alex Station, which was a unit dedicated solely to going after bin Laden, decided to rely almost entirely on covert operations, such as supporting the Pakistani intelligence service, supporting a small group of ex-Mujahideen, ex-Soviet fighters in Afghanistan, where there was no CIA supervision, and also supplying money and arms to Ahmed Massoud up in the Northern Alliance. None of those proved worthwhile. None of them had any even hope of finding and capturing and or killing bin Laden. And what's ironic is that the CIA during that period, Alex Station, never even tried to penetrate al-Qaeda, which I think is just outrageous. They thought it would be too hard and too dangerous to penetrate al-Qaeda. And what's very ironic is that at that very moment, that summer of 2001, when the CIA was thinking it was too hard or too dangerous to penetrate al-Qaeda, eight Americans had already joined al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and were at the bin Laden training camp, including one American from California, seven, I think, from Buffalo. So it showed that it was not only possible, it wasn't really that difficult to penetrate al-Qaeda. The only problem is that the CIA never even tried.
Well, there's another irony in your book, Jim, when you quote George Tenet, the former CIA director, as saying that the job of the intelligence community is not to observe and report, but to warn and protect. In the end, do you think these hearings are going to help stop the next attack?
I think they'll contribute to it. The problem is what doesn't really get focused at these hearings is the role of the U.S. foreign policy in all this. It's U.S. foreign policy that is driving the terrorists that are increasing, as they said at the hearings today. The terrorists are increasing. They're not decreasing in number. How can you be successful if your enemy is increasing? The ultimate role of U.S. foreign policy is the key element in this. They're not attacking Canada or Sweden. Mm-hmm. They're attacking the United States because of our long broken Middle East policy, capped off with this war in Iraq, which is doing nothing except creating more hatred and potential terrorists for the United States.
So, James, we'll have to leave it there. We thank you so much.
My pleasure.
James Bamford is the author of A Pretext for War, and we'll speak with him again tomorrow when the hearings resume.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
When singer Ray Charles died last week at the age of 73, one refrain often heard was, "He broke the color barriers." Well, social critic and historian Stephen Talty says it's musical breakthroughs like that that need to be celebrated more often. Moments when black and white pop culture intersect, creating something new and exciting. Stephen Talty's book is called Mulatto America at the Crossroads of Black and White Culture, A Social History. It was recently released in paperback, but we first spoke to him last year and asked, why the word mulatto?
Well, the book is more about cultural mixing than physical mixing. And mulatto was used as a term of sort of social derogation. It denoted how much black blood you had in you. I try to reclaim the word in a more enriching sense in the way that people like Ralph Ellison or even Derek Walcott, the Caribbean poet, have used it.
Mm. But, you know, you see it, and you see it in what you call intense moments of shared experience that I want to talk about. But some people would say, really, do you see that? Because it seems as if more and more there is television entertainment programs, for instance, that are watched almost entirely by black Americans and not even noted by whites. So some would see more ghettoizing of each culture.
That can be true, but I think if you look at the general culture, you have someone like Jay-Z sampling the Broadway show Annie for his biggest hit, Hard Knock Life. You don't get much wider than Annie. And you have people like Eminem basically coming of age with hip-hop. It's hard to imagine who Marshall Mathers would be without hip-hop. And even in fashion, you have kids in the ghetto wearing Burberry and Lacoste, while you have kids in the white suburbs wearing FUBU. I think today people, especially young Americans, don't look across the color line and say, well, that's a black-only idea or a white-only style. They really feel that the whole tradition belongs to them, even if there are segments of the popular culture that are still sort of segregated.
Mm. Tell us about some of these intense moments of shared experience. I mean, you just mentioned a few contemporary ones, but tell us about some of the others that you note.
Well, the second chapter, I look at religion. I look at the coming of Christianity to this country. And one thing that surprised me was that the first Methodist and Baptist churches in this country were often more integrated than they are, say, in Atlanta or Boston today. During the first Great Awakening, you had these biracial churches where slaves and masters were often members of the same congregation, and slaves could come before that congregation and sort of, you know, look for justice. They could say, I've been mistreated. Of course, that split later in the 1800s when you would have blacks being taught that the Bible is all about obeying your master, and so they would have to sneak off and have their own masses. But at the beginning, it was really sort of a profoundly mixed experience, and it was an experience where blacks could be recognized as human beings really for the first time or one of the only times in that slave society.
Mm-hmm. One of the most fascinating chapters is the whole chapter you devote to Sam Cooke. Why him?
Sam Cooke is really the secret hero of the book. He was sort of a gospel Mozart. But at a certain point in his life, he wanted to cross over, and he wanted to take his black audience with him. So he went pop, and even though blacks and whites alike told him, you know, don't you dare do that. But I think Sam Cooke really felt that the whole American tradition belonged to him. He had grown up listening not only to blues and gospel, which he loved, but also to Broadway and white pop. And he really felt that no one should tell him what belonged to him and what he couldn't do. So he was really sort of the ultimate American cultural mulatto. And he really tried to take everything in the society, even those things that were sort of denied him legally. I know you send me honest you do. I argue in the book that Sam Cooke is really sort of Elvis's partner in that cultural revolution that swept America in the 50s, even though he doesn't get the credit for it.
Well, Stephen, we've been focusing on the, as you say, intense shared experience between blacks and whites in America, but we're hearing now that Hispanics are passing blacks as the largest minority. Do you think that there's going to be that same cross-pollination between Hispanics and Caucasians?
I see it beginning to happen. I mean, especially in hip-hop, you have MCs like Fat Joe and Big Pun who have really taken Puerto Rican life and Latino life and really fused it with a black genre. And I do think maybe 30 years from now someone will write a book called Mestizo America about the, you know, the borrowings that go back and forth between Latino and the mainstream culture.
Mm. That's a whole other story, isn't it?
it's a whole other interesting story.
But I feel like, you know, I want to note that nothing will ever compare to the intense, petri dish that the black-white relations came out of, you know, which was slavery.
Absolutely. Because it came out of such an intense arena of suffering and pain, it really acquired a drama, an intensity that I think is going to be hard to match. Mm. And hopefully, you know, that intensity won't be matched because it'll be more of a pleasurable sharing than the black-white relationship, which has been so dramatically painful.
Stephen Tolte, what are you? Are you white or black or a little both? Or
I am first-generation Irish-American. I grew up actually in Buffalo, New York, which is in many ways a great place to grow up. But there probably wasn't a black family living within, say, a radius of 2 miles. But at the same time, I was a huge fan of things like hip-hop and black writers and black filmmakers. So I had this sort of invisible influence across the color line. And I think that's really how it happens for a lot of white people. I think they know, you know, Method Man or Jay-Z better than they know an actual human being down the block, which is why culture has been so important, because we do have this profound residential segregation in this country.
Mm. Well, Stephen, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Stephen Talty. His book is called Mulatto America at the Crossroads of Black and White Culture, A Social History.
I've been so many places in my life and time. I sung a lot of songs, I've made some bad rhymes. I've acted out my life in stages with 10,000 people watching. But we're alone and I'm just singing this song for you. I know your image of me is what I hope to be, babe. I treated you unkindly, but girl, can't you see?
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
A southern Iraqi oil pipeline has been attacked for the second time in 2 days, in essence shutting down oil exports there. Gunmen also killed a security chief for the state-run Northern Oil Company during that attack. All of this coming just 2 weeks before the planned June 30th turnover of sovereignty to Iraqis. Elizabeth Palmer, a correspondent for CBS News, is on the line from Baghdad. Elizabeth, welcome.
Hello.
How serious a setback is this? Because it sounds as if everything in oil production has pretty much come to a halt.
Well, the record of repairing things quickly is pretty good, but I think this is the first time that they've had to shut down altogether, certainly in the last 3 months. Iraq was managing to export 2 million barrels a day. Production was cut by a little more than half a couple of days ago by a pipeline blast in the north, and now this has shut it out altogether. So quite apart from really putting a serious dent into the flow of revenue into the country, which it desperately needs, it also puts intolerable load on already overstretched repair services. These attacks are relentless, at least one a day and sometimes several.
And also, the temperatures there are well over 100 degrees. What is this doing to the power supply?
The whole infrastructure of the country is groaning and sagging. People here have to live now with rolling power outages again, not only because the oil supply is interrupted, so the power plants are being starved of fuel, but also all the equipment is so old and patched together. So it's a very difficult time, and people who had already lost faith in the coalition now are working hard to try and find any faith in the government that's going to take office on the 1st of July officially, and they're pretty fed up.
How vulnerable are these pipelines?
It's a complicated pipeline network. There are lines going north into Turkey and Syria that are export lines. There are lines linking the power plants of the countries together with the oil fields for internal power generation, and then their export lines south. That's thousands of miles of pipeline, impossible to police or guard properly. The oil ministry is spending millions of dollars, a lot of it coming from the USAID, American taxpayers' money. They've hired 14,000 private security guards, but it's impossible. to be vigilant 24 hours a day over thousands of miles. And all it takes is a couple of rocket-propelled grenade rounds or perhaps a homemade bomb at a weak point in the pipeline, maybe at a compressor station, and the whole thing blows and goes up in flames, and that's, you know, many, many hours of repair work involved once the fire's out.
And do we know which of the various insurgent groups might be behind these attacks?
All of them, probably. If you look at where the attacks occur, they occur across the country, in the Kurdish area, down south in the Shiite area, and here in central Iraq, where the Sunni insurgents have been working. They certainly all have a common purpose, that is to disrupt the normal functioning of the country. They're really attacking the lifeblood, if you like, of Iraq by blowing up the pipelines.
Elizabeth, this is happening just as Iraq was almost at its pre-war oil production levels. What's the impact now on the world oil market?
Mostly the rise and fall in prices is a psychological effect. So clearly something as visible as big pipeline fires and so on have an effect on the market. Practically speaking, it's not putting world supply in jeopardy, but it does show people that counting on Iraq's oil fields to perhaps back up the Saudi oil fields if there's real political instability in Saudi Arabia, which is a real possibility, Iraq's not going to be the backup anytime soon that people were hoping for.
Elizabeth, thank you.
Pleasure.
Elizabeth Palmer is a correspondent for CBS News. She joined us on the line from Baghdad. The kidnappers of American Paul Johnson released a videotape of their captive on Tuesday and threatened to kill him unless authorities in Saudi Arabia release Mujahideen militants from Saudi prisons within 3 days. In the past week, 3 Westerners have been attacked and killed there. An advisor to the Saudi government says Islamic militants are trying to scare foreign workers into leaving Saudi Arabia. But earlier today, we spoke with Anne Marie, a secretary from Scotland. She works in a hospital in Riyadh and has been in Saudi Arabia for about 2.5 years. She asked us not to use her last name or identify the hospital, but said she's not scared.
I did feel a little unsafe last week, but where I work, they're really putting a lot of effort into making us feel secure.
For example, what kinds of things are they doing?
There's lots more military around, and there's, you know, guards, and they're sealing off some doors, and the security at the compounds are much higher.
When you leave your place of employment, the hospital, do mm-hmm. you have bodyguards with you? Do you go by yourself? Do you go with a friend?
We go by bus. I feel no danger at all.
And do they have guards on the bus?
No.
Do you think that those of us in the West who are hearing these reports are getting unduly alarmed about them?
Well, you know, my family, they have a lot of news coverage in the UK, and they seem to be so much more concerned about what's happening over here than what I am. You know, I think it's been blown out of proportion. I know that it's bad. I know that people have been killed, but my family are very, very worried about me. But I have to reassure them all the time that I feel safe, and if I was in any danger, I would come home.
What about at the hospital? Have officials there called all of the Western employees together and said, you need to be a little more careful these days, or is that just assumed that you know that?
They have taken measures to assure us that everything's going to be okay and we have to be vigilant.
And what do they suggest in terms of extra vigilance?
I mean, there's things that you do anyway. You know, for women, you cover up and be careful of, you know, where you go and, you know, not to be on your own. When I first arrived here, obviously it was none of this was happening, and, you know, you go out shopping, you know, you go into town and you go to the markets, etc. But a lot more Westerners are not doing that just now. They're just, you know, being aware of what's happening around them.
And do you think they're feeling or your friends feeling a higher level of anxiety because of these attacks, or do you seem to be taking it in stride?
Yeah, of course we were anxious about it, but you know, I think a lot of people are quite blasé about what's happening, and you know, it won't happen to me, this sort of thing. If you really want to leave, you feel that much danger, you just leave.
But you're staying.
I'm staying just now, yes, because I like it here, and I have lots of Saudi friends here who I like very much. I would like to go home when I'm ready, not when I'm pushed out. You know, I don't have any children. I'm not married, so I'm basically looking after myself.
Well, Anne-Marie, thank you.
Thank you.
We hope you can stay safe.
Thank you very much.
Anne-Marie works in a hospital in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia.
Still to come, the tale of the saint and the sinner, Father Joe and satirist Tony Hendra.
You're listening to Here and Now.
The Detroit Pistons upset the superstar Los Angeles Lakers last night, winning the NBA title, the first for them since 1990, in five games. The Pistons also upset many a sports prognosticator. Ron Rappaport, sports writer for the Chicago Sun-Times, is on the line. Say, didn't I hear you say something like the only way the Pistons could win is if they bored the Lakers to death?
Something like that, Robin. Thanks for reminding me. The only excuse I have is that I'm not the only one. We were really, really surprised. I saw a poll before the season began where it asked people how they thought the series would go, and then one of the choices was, who thinks the Pistons will win in four or five games? 2.8% of the respondents. I mean, I would think you'd get that many just from the browsers in Detroit alone. But having said that, we were wrong. The Pistons were magnificent. The Lakers never, ever played their game. It would have been a sweep but for a miraculous shot by Kobe Bryant in the second game that sent that game into overtime at home. But otherwise, I just thought they played tremendously good basketball. They never gave the Lakers a chance to get into their game in five straight games, and this is a great team with great players, many of them headed for the Hall of Fame, and they just never got on track.
First title for Coach Larry Brown, who made a nice nod to Rick Carlisle, who was the coach of the team. He said that Rick, you know, created this team for him. Rick, of course, was fired from Detroit. He became the coach of the Indiana Pacers. But the Pistons were magnificent, but what happened to the Lakers?
You know, I just think that all of the turmoil and all of the craziness and all of the bickering from the season finally caught up with them. I was just startled watching that series. You never saw Showtime. You never saw the ball flying up and down the court, except in Game 5 when the Pistons were doing it. It was a Detroit kind of series. Every game was fairly low scoring. Every game was defensively oriented, and the Lakers simply could not get into their running, flashy kind of game. Remember, they struggled during the year, and then they came together towards the end and during the early rounds of the playoff, and they fooled us. They made us think that the olden days were back again. But they had struggled this year, and then they righted themselves, and finally it all seemed to catch up with them at the same time. I saw one quote by Rick Fox that kind of summed it up. He said, we picked a bad time to become a group of individuals instead of a team. Right. Teams are what win championships.
Well, what happens now? We hear that Coach Phil Jackson is not at all happy with the owner of the Lakers, and that he, in fact, might now bump Rick Carlisle from the Indiana Pacers, you know, look around for a new team?
Well, I think if Phil does leave the Lakers, he's going to take some time off. He's talked about never coaching again, although his agent, Todd Musburger, here in Chicago, says don't take that too seriously. I think that what the Lakers need to do, and what they will do, because they have some smart people there, is take their time, take a blow, take a breather, give everybody a couple of months off, see what happens with Kobe Bryant's court situation, see if maybe there's a way to bring him back, talk to Phil a little bit. I think this is a very, very bad time to make key decisions. It's still a great team with a lot of really good players. It obviously needs to make some key changes, but whether you want to back up the truck and start over again, I've got an example of what can happen to that. It's called the Chicago Bulls.
Right. But meantime, let's remember the winners. Detroit police were ready for rioting in the streets last night. After all, the last time they won, people died. But so far, so good. Just a big party.
So far, so good. A big party, although I did see one report, Robin, of, quote, celebratory gunfire, kind of like for a wedding in Iraq. I hope that things are calm and quiet and everybody in Detroit takes their very well-deserved championship in good stead and good humor.
And if you're a betting person, don't ever go betting with Ron. Thank you.
Okay.
Ron Rappaport, sports writer for the Chicago Sun-Times.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Tony Hendra is funny. One of the creators of the National Lampoon, he also played Ian Faith in the hit mockumentary Spinal Tap. He was the short-tempered, cricket-bat-wielding band manager who orders a stage set built to replicate Stonehenge.
This is the piece?
Yes.
Are you telling me that this is it? This is scenery? Have you ever been to Stonehenge?
No, the triptychs,
the triptychs are 20 feet high. You can stand four men up them.
Ian, I was
this
asked
is,
to build
this is insane.
Triptych
this isn't a piece of scenery.
Look, this is what I was asked to build. 18 inches, right here, it's specified, 18 inches. I was given this napkin, I mean...
Forget this!
Tony Hendra is funny, which is why so many people are surprised at the spiritual depth and critical reaction to his latest work. The New York Times Book Review calls it one of the best spiritual memoirs ever written, saying, "I beg you to read this book." It's called Father Joe, The Man Who Saved My Soul, and it tells what happened after a 14-year-old Tony had an unconsummated affair with a troubled, married, Catholic woman 10 years his senior. He meets the flat-footed, goofily grinning Father Joseph Warlow, who first inspires him to be a monk, then quietly guides him through the lows and lows of American super celebrity. And then, well, we asked Tony Hendra to tell the story himself, starting with his first impression of Father Joe.
He had an extraordinary stillness about him, which kind of enfolded you. It's as if peace came off him as tangibly as aftershave. Mm. And I was utterly captivated. He judged nothing. He never mentioned hell. He never mentioned punishment. He never mentioned sin. In fact, he said that the only sin that I had committed was, as he put it, he had rather a stutter, a sort of English stutter. And he said, "The only sin you've committed, my dear, is the sin of selfishness."
Huh. Because, as he said to you, you hadn't thought about her,
the
woman that you were having this relationship with.
Precisely.
Well, you write, "I felt on the brink of learning an entirely new set of possible responses to the world." In fact, you wanted to become him, but he rebuffed your attempts to join the monastery.
Yes, he did. He very gently dissuaded me from this, and said that I had to go to Cambridge, because I had a scholarship to Cambridge.
And then you discover comedy.
On a whim, one night I went to see a show in Cambridge called Beyond the Fringe, and I was completely captivated by this. It seemed to me, in fact, almost on the order of a kind of religious experience. And I went into that theater a monk, and I came out a satirist. I should say that I never lost touch with Father Joe as a man and a mentor. I certainly lost my faith and stopped practicing as a Catholic. But there was something about Joe that kept drawing me back. I always needed a dose of that stillness. Looking back on that when I wrote the book, I realized that this was when the prodigal began to return to the father, really. As you probably know, Spinal Tap was completely improvised. Well, there's only one real rule about improvisation, which is that you must listen. I realized that years and years before, Father Joe had said something almost identical, which was that listening is the way to reach out over what he called the walls of the prison of self. Listening really is the first act of love. Suddenly, how did I let myself get out of the habit of being with this man and hearing this kind of wisdom? He never went to a movie. He never saw a television show. He never listened to an album. He didn't have a driver's license. But somehow this man had a sort of reservoir of intuition about the human condition and human activity of all kinds that never ceased to amaze me.
There's one a passage that I love, when you have made one such visit, and you're spiraling out at this point, and you go visit him, and you have an exchange where you try to explain to him what a satirist is. But then, through this sort of Socratic kind of questioning, he makes you see what you've become.
We were talking about the nature of, the dynamic of satire, really. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, there's an us-them dynamic to almost all humor. And he said, Well, do you mean that you have to divide the world into two kinds of people, my dear? He said. And I said, yes, that's the way the world works. And he thought about this for quite a long time. And then he said, well, you see, dear, I think there are two kinds of people in the world. The kind who divide the world into two kinds of people and the kind that don't. And with one insight, he showed me that, in fact, I had become the kind of person that divides the world into two kinds of people and was seriously damaged by the damage that I was causing to others.
Yeah. You also have a failed marriage under your belt, and you confess to, you know, not paying attention to your two first children. And at this point of the book, I'm realizing there are very few pages left, and I'm rooting for you. I'm so rooting for you to come to some awareness in time, because he's getting much older. Tell us what happened.
Well, in short form, I actually had remarried and was having serious doubts that I was going to make a go of this marriage either. And to make a long story short, I came, as I always did in these moments of crisis, to Father Joe. And what I ended up doing during that visit to Core Abbey was presenting myself again at the age of 48, I guess it was, as a postulant to the monastery. Not only did he turn me down, but he said one of the most devastating things that I think anyone's ever said to me in his gentle way. He said, from the first time I laid eyes on you, my dear, I knew you'd never make a monk. And all my life, I realized that I had carried this option in my back pocket that I could always run away to the monastery and escape from the world and become a monk. And he said, over my objections, he said, your vocation is as a husband and a father, and it's just as sacred as mine. And that's what you must do.
Hmm. Well, you return to your wife, engage in your marriage, have a child, and then there is a moment where you are just in time. Do you mind describing that?
Not at all. This happened in 1998 when I had come to see Joe, and as a bonus, I'd brought along my 6-year-old son, Sebastian, because I knew he adored children. And I thought that would make his day. And he was very frail, but he was by now 89 years old and had beaten cancer. And I immediately saw that one of his eyes was being almost forced from its socket. And in that moment, I realized not only that the cancer had returned, but that if he was in the monastery and not a hospital, then he was going to die. And, I've never been so devastated in my life. But Sebastian, my son, gave him a hug and a kiss, and he was transported. His face looked like a window into heaven. And he said, I've just had a visit from an angel.
Well... at one point in your story, Tony Hendra, I think it was right after the Spinal Tap epiphany, you know, about listening and love, you start to think that maybe Father Joe is God?
Yes, actually, or at least some body that God from time to time visited, because he clearly had himself some contact with the divine. And I think that's really what we mean by saint. You understand when you meet someone like this man that the inconceivable can only become conceivable to us if we do it through the medium of someone who has touched himself or herself, the inconceivable.
Do you think of him often now?
I think of him all the time, actually.
Author Tony Hendra talking about his friend, the late Father Joe Warrilow. Tony's book is called Father Joe, The Man Who Saved My Soul.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.